figured it out a long time ago. Always go in the first period. It's the main thing. You don't show up first period, ring, ring, calling your house. And that's not good. Always take the back door. Security guards don't see me at all whatsoever. They're in the front, writing stuff down and talking to each other, and they don't even see me pass through that back door. I'm too slick for them.
Middle schooler named Orlando talking about his techniques for cutting class. Truancy is a huge problem in California, and chronic truancy is directly linked to crime. Later in the show, we talk with California's Attorney General Kamala Harris and others about efforts to keep more kids in school. But first, immigration officials have agreed to let some deported migrants come back to California. It's part of a settlement in a lawsuit brought by the Southern California ACLU. Migrants had agreed to be voluntarily deported, but the ACLU says they did so because federal agents intimidated and deceived them. As part of the settlement in the case, the feds have even agreed to launch an ad campaign in Mexico. That campaign will let people know that they might be eligible to come back to the United States. Lucero Chavez is an attorney with the ACLU, and she was involved in bringing the case. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, tell us first, what is the voluntary deportation program?
Sure. In practice, a voluntary departure is a type of relief that an individual can take to leave the country without a formal deportation order. The person waives their right to a hearing before before a judge. They waive any asylum claims, and they agree to be immediately returned back to their country. Now, the problem with this process, that while for some it may be a good option, for many who may have pending petitions to adjust their status through family members or who may be able to fight their case in immigration court, they're not told, at least before the settlement, they were not told that the minute they leave the country, they may be subject to years of bars before being able to return.
So you can't come back immediately. You have to wait a long time before you try to come back?
Exactly. It can be up to 10 years that someone has to wait to even apply to come back to the country.
Okay. And you alleged in your lawsuit that federal agents coerced and deceived some people just to get them to agree to this voluntary deportation. How did they do that?
Yeah, so especially in the case of our named plaintiff, Ms. Lopez Venegas, she was picked up on the street by a Border Patrol agent. She was with her young son, who suffers from some mental disabilities, when she was picked up. When officers were presenting her the option of voluntary return, they said, sign this form or you will be detained for months, you will be separated from your child, and if you try to fight your case, you're going to be deported anyway. Sign this form, you'll return to Mexico as soon as possible with your son, and you'll be able to fix your status later on. So that's just one example of the misinformation that was provided and the coercion really that folks were presented with when given this life-changing decision placed in front of them.
And how many plaintiffs did you have in your lawsuit?
We have nine named plaintiffs.
You have nine plaintiffs. Okay. And so what happens with them now?
So through the settlement process, some of them have been able to return and the rest will be returning again likely this week, pursuant to the various terms of the settlement agreement. We will continue to pursue the class claims because it was a class action lawsuit on behalf of many people who were impacted by this process of voluntary departure and misinformed and coerced into signing their voluntary departure. We will be presenting a motion for class certification in September, and these named plaintiffs will be able to continue to fight their individual cases in immigration court as well as this class action suit.
So with the class action suit, how many people are you saying were coerced and deceived?
As far as we know, at least 400,000 people since 2009 have taken a voluntary departure from across the nation. When looking more specifically at Southern California, which is the region that the settlement covers, we could be looking at hundreds of thousands of people as well, because again, the forms that were presented to people, the advisals that were given to people, they were insufficient and they were misinformed. And so we imagine and estimate at least hundreds of people will be able to benefit from the settlement agreement and apply to return to the United States.
But you're not saying that all of those 400,000 people since 2009, all of them were coerced into leaving?
No, we imagine that some individuals may have had access to counsel. We imagine that some individuals may have thought that that was their best option. But from what we've alleged in our complaint and what we saw through the intakes that we received through our clients and our organizational plaintiffs, we know that the abuse was widespread. Our case is obviously limited to Southern California, and we know that at least the lack of information that people had in making the decision was present for everyone.
But is this essentially a bump in the road for them? In other words, they'll be able to return, but eventually will be deported when they go through all the proper channels?
For the individuals that will benefit from the class relief, one of the requirements for them to be a class member or class representative is that they could have benefited from some form of relief if they had not taken a voluntary departure. For example, if they qualified for the president's deferred action program and came here when they were young kids, or if they're married to a U.S. citizen, that could give them the ability to stay. So most of these people will actually have the ability to lawfully remain in the United States had it not been for the voluntary departure and being subject to these 10-year bars.
So part of your settlement, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has agreed to change the processing for voluntary deportees. And what is going to happen? What's going to change?
Yes, so the other big change and the other big win that we have as part of the settlement is that ICE and Border Patrol officers will now be affirmatively prohibited from using misinformation or pressure to try to convince individuals to waive their rights to a hearing. Officers will also have to give detailed information, both in writing and orally, about what it really means to take a voluntary departure, meaning the consequences of taking it, versus being able to see an immigration judge. There will also be a 1-800 hotline that's created to give people information from a neutral third party about people's rights regarding the consequences of voluntary departure. And one of the other things that we also saw with our individual clients is that when folks were presented with the options of seeing a judge, taking voluntary departure, or if they had a claim to asylum, they were given a form that had the voluntary departure option already pre-checked. So in the future going forward, that check can no longer be on the form. An individual will have to physically mark the option that they want to take.
And then talk a little bit, if you will, about this media campaign in Mexico.
Yes. So in order for this settlement really to become effective and for the class relief to be fulfilled, people need to know that it's available to them. So from June of 2009 to August 18th of this year, anyone who has taken a voluntary departure and meets a certain other criteria will be able to apply for class membership and to return. In order for people in Mexico to know that this is an option, obviously they will have to have information about the requirements, what documents they should start getting together. And so as part of the settlement, there will be a massive public awareness campaign in Mexico as well as in Southern California, because we recognize that many people have family members who remain in the United States and may be able to get in touch with them. But the point of the publicity campaign will be to get the word out there that if folks think they qualify, they should go to a certain website, they should call certain designated service providers, and begin the process of trying to return to the United States to fight their cases.
Lucero Chavez, attorney with the Southern California ACLU, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Okay, lawsuits, settlements, and piecemeal executive actions, not really the comprehensive immigration reform that politicians have been promising in the last few election cycles. The president is increasingly threatening executive actions in the absence of such reform.
I take executive action only when we have a serious problem, a serious issue, and Congress chooses to do nothing. And in this situation, the failure of House Republicans to pass a darn bill is bad for our security, it's bad for our economy, and it's bad for our future.
That was the president giving a speech on executive actions earlier this summer. And over the next few months, any of those actions, especially a big one, could prove to be explosive come November and the midterm elections. Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So the president is taking immigration reform into his own hands for the most part at this point. And besides the general grumbling and shouting that accompanies any executive action, members of both parties really seem to be popping Xanax every time they think of him doing something on immigration. Why?
Well, that's because the president has promised that whatever action he takes, and the numbers that are being thrown around are pretty big, but, you know, as many as 5 million illegal immigrants, maybe that's almost half the estimated number in the country, could be given a legal status. It's supposed to happen by the end of the summer, which is also coinciding with about 7 to 8 weeks before a very big midterm election. So what you've seen across the country is just about every Democrat who is in a tight Senate race right now is denouncing this, trying to distance themselves from it, because most of these races are taking place in some pretty conservative states where the president is not very popular. And in the meantime, the Republicans aren't exactly doing a happy dance about it because they know that this is exactly the kind of thing that can sort of set off the elements of their party that would immediately start talking about impeachment or shutting down the government over this, which, of course, is not exactly the thing that they want to see right before an election.
And when you're talking about elements, you're talking mainly about the Tea Party?
Yes. And, you know, Congressman Steve King of Iowa is already saying, you know, and people, you know, Marco Rubio is even flirting with government shutdown talk. And we do know that these things don't tend to work out very well for the Republicans.
Well, and yet candidates in elections across the country are using this in their platforms. Here's a clip from Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who's now running for a Senate seat in New Hampshire.
Thanks to the pro-amnesty policies of President Obama and Senator Shaheen, we have an immigration crisis on our hands. We respond with compassion, but it's time for us to secure the border once and for all.
So is that the major and the main campaign themes that we're seeing? We're seeing border control and enforcement and not amnesty?
It actually goes to some broader themes as well. And there's a storyline out there. There's an argument being made by Republicans that this president is simply out of control, that he goes way beyond his constitutional authority. So, yes, this is about immigration on one level. This is about border security. But it is also about this larger narrative that the Republicans are painting at the president.
Well, what about on the Democratic side, on the part of lawmakers who are not from states that are contested in the midterms and especially in the Senate? What are they saying about immigration reform?
Well, Democrats see a long-term benefit to, you know, given the fact the rapid growth of the Hispanic demographic as part of the electorate, they see a long-term benefit in this. But the problem is that most of these races that will determine the control of the United States Senate come next January are in states that are not particularly favorable territory, the exception being Colorado. This is something that and Senator Mark Udall, who's running for re-election there, has actually called upon the president to take aggressive action. But again, this is, you know, it's not likely to affect the balance of power in the House, but it could in the Senate.
So what was all this talk several election cycles previously of the empowered Hispanic voters and how that they could turn elections and that immigration was going to be a big issue for both parties that they needed to get behind? Has that just faded?
It really has. The Senate did, in fact, pass a comprehensive immigration overhaul that got absolutely nowhere in the House. And then we've had the crisis on the border this summer, which has really, the number of unaccompanied minors who are flooding the border has really brought the immigration issue back to the fore, but again, in a context where I think in a lot of parts of the country, people are wondering why the border isn't more secure.
So when you look at all of this, what do you think the president is likely to do in terms of an executive action?
Well, I talked to people at the White House, and they said that there are a number of issues that they really still haven't worked out. Number one being, what are the limits of the president's authority? But they are worried that if they do this, they have to do it in a way that he can communicate, in a way that people would understand. They say there are just a thicket of administrative issues, and they are worried about the effect that the timing could have on the outcome for the election.
Well, is there also a thought in some perverse way that if they do this and provoke a response from the more right-wing fringes of the Republican Party, such as an impeachment threat or a shutting down the government threat, that might actually play into the Democrats' hands because people don't like it when the government is shut down?
That is something that a number of senior Republicans are very much worried about, because don't forget, John Boehner and the Speaker of the House has a brand new, unseasoned leadership team over there. And again, you know, their ability to sort of he hasn't had a good relationship anyway with the Tea Party members of the House, but their ability to sort of keep this under control is they themselves are worried about that.
Okay, a lot of worry there in Washington. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we want to know what you think. What would you like to see when it comes to immigration reform? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or join our conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we learned after the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that there's no national database for police shootings or for any other police activity. Well, we're going to talk to a police officer who is helping to create one. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We know about the shootings when they make headlines. White police officer shoots unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri. But what about the cop-related shootings that don't make headlines? Turns out there's no single place to track police behavior, from shootings on down to routine traffic stops. There's no national database. But that's about to change. Tracy Kizzee is co-founder of the Center for Policing Equity at UCLA, which is creating a national clearinghouse. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, why do we need a national database?
Well, first, we really don't have a standardized way to collect data across the United States that really can capture whether or not the stops that you've been hearing about or the behavior you've been hearing about over the last several weeks is definitely creating some type of disparate racial issue.
So police departments, from tiny rural departments on up to big, huge metros, don't collect data or don't collect data in the same way?
You're correct. So some do collect it, and they don't necessarily all collect it in the same way. And then you have some that don't collect it at all.
So what would you do? Would you work with each department to make sure they're doing it the same way?
Well, that's the way the justice database is designed. But the first thing we want to do is get a reporting. So we want to start to gather some of that information so we can kind of begin to get a temperature or a feel for what the data is telling us. But the ultimate goal is just that, is to have standardized data collection where we can do the necessary analysis to see what's going on.
And would police departments across the country embrace this, or would they say, oh, this is too onerous, too costly, too time-consuming?
And that's part of the discussion on when you're creating a justice database. It's going to be a little bit of all of that. So, you know, definitely there's going to be some costs that's probably going to be attached to some of that. To others who are already collecting, it could be as easy as just pushing the data into the database. And that's really the point of needing to go by department and looking at what the setups already are.
So you really have to start at the very beginning just to find out what's out there. You don't even know that.
Well, you do. And so in June, we definitely brought together a lot of law enforcement and NGOs and researchers and to really begin to identify what are those things that we need to collect. But it goes beyond just, you know, data collection. You're dealing with organizational cultures and how is this information, you know, gathered on the street, and how is it explained to the officers who have a concern about how this information is going to be used?
Well, now you are a police officer yourself. You've been one for 25 years, I understand, in a major city, not here in L.A. So as a police officer, what do you think the reaction is to this kind of thing?
Well, you're going to get a couple of reactions. Probably the majority reaction is going to be some pushback, because one of the things that we have found in our research is that, you know, the biggest thing officers really dread and fear is being called a racist. Those who are going about doing the right business every day and doing the right things, you know, don't want to be a part of that conversation. And then you're going to have some who will just say, you know, hey, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, so I don't really have any fears about what you're looking at. And there really is some concern, and those are very valid, honest concerns.
Right, because data can always be interpreted in various ways.
Absolutely. Right. And really, for us, it's not just about the numbers. That's why you also have to talk about officer behaviors. What are they learning in the academy? How are policies being implemented? So there's multiple levels to it. But, you know, again, the officer on the street, their concerns are very legitimate.
So give me an example of what the database might look like with a routine traffic stop.
Well, I mean, what you typically will have is a set of elements that are data sets that you're collecting from each of the departments, and whether that is the time of day the person was stopped, you know, vehicle description, driver description, you know, what was going on, what was the reason for the stops. So those are some of the basic things that we'd be looking for, and that, you know, not everybody captures. So it's really a lot of building from the ground up to make sure that we can capture some of the basic things.
But then you have all sorts of interpretations of fact, as we saw what happened in Ferguson. I mean, we may never know what happened in Ferguson, and maybe not because there wasn't a police database, but because there are different interpretations as to what happened. Was the suspect fleeing? Was he not fleeing? Was he violent? Was he not violent? Was he a threat to the officer? Was he not a threat to the officer? And all of that is open to interpretation. So how is that captured in a database?
Well, and that's part of the difficulty of quantifying those behaviors. And so part of the thing that you have to do with the data set is when we talk about what disparate behavior means, or, you know, what the actions of those officers, the actions of those suspects are, all of those things are relevant to the conversation. But the other part of that that I think you're kind of getting to with so many different things impacting interpretation is exactly what are we looking at? And that is the question that the Justice Database was set up for. What really are we looking at? Are we looking at a behavior that may have been spurned from something else prior to police contact? I mean, so those are questions that, you know, not just we as researchers, but, you know, police chiefs and everyone else are having the exact same question. Just how much impact is law enforcement having on that?
Who wants to have this information?
Well, police chiefs want to have it, for one, and communities want to have it as well. I mean, part of the conversation going around with Ferguson is transparency. What's really going on when we talk about police interaction and police relationships with communities of color? So, I mean, everybody really wants to benefit, not just to get this information, but how do we make that relationship better? And then, you know, chiefs want to know, how do we provide a better service?
So this is primarily to assess whether or not there is racial disparity in terms of police interaction?
That's correct. And it's those interactions where they typically end in the accusation that the only reason why, you know, fill in the blank, is because I'm a person of color. So we'll be looking at that. But one of the things we have to do on a broader scale as well, and what we'll do with our researchers, is look at what are those other impacts from society as large where there's also been disparate findings. So that's education, so that's, you know, economics, so it's all types of things that'll be in there. And so that will also take in consideration what's happening outside of that police community contact.
So this sounds like an enormous project. When do you expect it to be completed?
Well, completion, I don't think I would say as a police officer, it should never be complete. It should be something that's ongoing and growing as things change. But we're hoping to have our first kind of blush look at some of the data sets for our early departments within hopefully a year to 2 years.
Oh, so fairly soon.
Hopefully.
What kind of initial data are you getting?
Well, you know, some of the initial data is exactly what's already been collected by individual departments. So we were starting to get some of those things. Here's what we've collected. Here's what it looks like. So it's a lot of aggregate data that we're just pulling in to see what we can make sense of.
And so do we have any idea how many shootings take place along the lines of a Ferguson? How many police shootings of unarmed suspects take place?
That's part of the problem. We don't have one place where we can go. So we definitely know about police shootings. a lot of times we don't know the context of what occurred during those events. And so that's, you know, one of the biggest complaints that we've been hearing is how do we know or how do we report? And so we're hoping that the Justice Database will help with that as well.
So why aren't the feds doing this?
That's a good question. I think it's a question for the feds.
Have you asked them?
We have not asked them personally, no, but I'm sure they've been asked a lot over the last month.
Tracy Kesey, co-founder of the Center for Policing Equity at UCLA, which is creating a national database of police actions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think? Do you think a national registry of police behavior is important, necessary, or do you worry that the statistics will be taken out of context and misused? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us your thoughts at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, speaking of data, California is just one of four states that doesn't track kids who skip school. Chronic truancy is a big problem because it can lead to a future life of crime. Attorney General Kamala Harris is here to talk about her legislation to address truancy. That's next on Press Play after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Right now, a package of bills that would crack down on school truancy is sitting on Governor Jerry Brown's desk awaiting his signature. Chronic truancy, which is defined as missing 10% of the school year or around 18 days, is a problem that California's top law enforcement official says is directly linked to crime. And that is why Attorney General Kamala Harris initiated the truancy bills on the governor's desk, and she's here to discuss them. Welcome.
Thank you.
California has a lot of pressing criminal justice issues, including the ongoing realignment of our prisons to reduce overcrowding, death penalty issues. Why prioritize school truancy?
Elementary school truancy, I think, really highlights the intersection between public safety and public education. What we know is that in California, because I conducted a study last year, we had 1 million elementary school students who were truant. 250,000 California elementary school truants or students missed over 10% of the school year. We also know that an elementary school student who is truant is 3 to 4 times likely to become a high school dropout. We also know that 82% of the prisoners in the United States are high school dropouts. There's a very direct connection. And so this package of bills that's on the governor's desk will actually help California do a better job and make sure those children are in class. And essentially, what we found, for example, in our assessment and analysis of the issue in our state, is that California is one of four states in the United States of America that does not track attendance on a statewide level. One of the bills will require that we do that. We are requiring that school districts comply with the governor's local control funding formula, which says that we should distribute resources to school districts with some eye toward how many children in that school district are in foster care, how many are coming from a family where English is the second language, figuring out in a very smart way what we can do to distribute resources in a way that they go to the areas most in need. Elementary school truancy is something that can be fixed, but we really do need to upgrade our system and, in particular, adopt technology in a way that we can track and then ensure that the youngest of our children are in school every day. And essentially, listen, there are many debates about the quality of our education system, but those debates are moot if the children aren't in class in the first place.
Mm. So what do you think are the major reasons why elementary school students are truant?
Well, I've studied this for a number of years, back when I was district attorney of San Francisco up until now as attorney general, and I'll tell you the reasons are varied. The vast majority of parents of elementary school students want to raise their children to be productive, thriving adults. But they're overwhelmed by the circumstances of their lives. They may be transient because they have been the victim of a foreclosure. We find that there are parents who just don't realize that third grade reading level will actually determine one's lot in life, and in particular, that the studies are very clear that if by the end of third grade a child is not at third grade reading level, they literally drop off because, of course, before third grade the child is learning to read, and then comprehension kicks in, and then the child is reading to learn. If they've not been in class every day through the end of third grade, it is very unlikely that they have the skills to then go on to the next phase, which is about comprehension. And so what obviously and logically ends up happening is that they start to enter school at a deficit. It is not enjoyable. They feel like they're not the smart kid in class, and they start to lose interest. And invariably, that's the kid who is going to be the high school dropout. We can address this, and I think that we have to recognize that there are many challenges that we face and many issues that we consider big issues, but most of them can be traced back to what we might consider a relatively small issue. But, and in this case, elementary school truancy is one of those issues that is a time bomb waiting to happen if we don't address it immediately. And I know that we can when we upgrade our system and we do the work that we know is about being smart, smart in terms of government and how we work, and smart on crime, to be frank, and looking at what we can do in terms of prevention as probably one of the most effective ways of reducing crime and increasing public safety.
So is the idea that if you get them in the elementary school setting, that that's easier to combat truancy rather than wait till they get to high school, when it just seems to be something that is a lot more difficult to control and address?
Well, elementary school truancy is the pathology and the issues surrounding it are very different than high school truancy, for example, and any of us who are raising children can speak to just the different phases of life that are present in elementary versus high school. We have decided to take on elementary school truancy because we believe we can actually fix this problem. And certainly we know that elementary school truancy is a great predictor of high school truancy and high school dropout rates.
So are you saying we're not going to address the high school truancy issue at this point?
Well, it's a matter of triage. So we've decided to take on elementary school truancy because we have to start somewhere. And it is a very specific phase and with very specific variables that we have identified and are prepared to address. Not to the exclusion of the importance of dealing with high school truancy, but elementary school truancy is where we've decided to focus. And in particular because, you know, most people are not aware. It's pretty surprising. Most people are not aware that we have so many elementary school students who are just not in class every day.
And they're not in class for lots of reasons, and a lot of them associated with poverty and English language learning issues and, you know, immigration issues and all sorts of things. I mean, these are huge societal problems. And are you optimistic, though, that, you know, a package of bills can fix most of these large societal problems? I mean, is this something we can legislate our way out of?
I think that when we talk about, as you've discussed, large societal problems, we cannot afford to be overwhelmed by the enormity of it. We have to step back and then identify the discrete variables that lead to large societal problems and then address them head on, each one of them. Elementary school truancy is one of those issues that we can solve.
Kamala Harris, California's Attorney General, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The state's trying to get a handle on the truancy problem, largely by doing a better job of tracking kids who skip out on classes. But what exactly can be done to keep kids in school? One national nonprofit group provides what are essentially social workers to support truant kids, especially in poorer areas. It's called Communities in Schools, and Deborah Marcus is executive director of the Los Angeles chapter. She's here now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on.
My pleasure. Well, first of all, considering the legislation that Kamala Harris is sponsoring and is on the governor's desk, is that the kind of legislation that you want to see, or are there other ways of attacking this in a more effective way?
I think this is exactly the type of legislation that we want to see. When we look at attendance, there's many challenges in understanding attendance recording practices, tracking practices within the schools and between schools and within the district. So I think that a lot of the legislation focuses on enhancing those practices and those reporting mechanisms. I think it's critically important. We at Communities and Schools see a direct correlation between attendance and academic success. At the schools in Los Angeles Unified School District with whom we are partnered, we see average daily attendance fluctuate between 70% to 96%. And 96% sounds okay, but when you put it into real numbers, it's quite astonishing. There are 180 school days in the LAUSD calendar, so when a child misses 10% or is coming 90% of the time, that's 18 days missed a school year. So that's quite alarming.
And so 18 days, and that's on the high end.
That's on the high end, yeah. At certain times of the year, you know, we see attendance rates drop to around 70% at some of our most challenging schools, and that's usually in the spring.
Can you figure out why kids aren't going to classes, why some kids aren't going and some kids are?
Yes, we can. And the way that we do that is by developing relationships with students and their parents. We ask, why are kids not coming to school? And we're not going to be making assumptions, right? So every child, every family comes to school with a different story. Sometimes a child is not coming to school because of issues very directly related to poverty, lack of appropriate clothing, or because they're hungry, or because they're tired, or because they're afraid of getting to school because they're walking into, you know, gang territory. We see that a lot. Recently at Manual Arts High School in South Los Angeles, one of our students' friend was involved in a gang-related incident after school. That kid did not want to come to school that week because he was afraid of additional retaliation.
So how do you combat that? I mean, you'd have to work with the police department, I guess.
We work with police departments. We work with social service agencies. We work with mental health agencies. We work with the wellness clinics that are provided by LAUSD on many of our campuses. We work with school psychiatric social workers and PSA counselors.
And so would it get to the point where someone would actually go to a kid's house and escort that kid to school?
That has absolutely happened.
Wow.
So oftentimes the Communities and Schools site coordinator, that social service specialist, is that person that is developing a relationship with the child on campus and saying, hey, I'm watching you. I'm here to support you. You can do this. Children want to succeed. Their families want them to succeed. There are just oftentimes circumstances that are beyond their control that make that a challenge.
What about the stick approach, which has been used in the past with either school safety officers or even LAPD police officers arresting kids or ticketing kids for not getting to school on time or skipping school. That has been scaled back, and I don't think that happens very much anymore. But is that effective, or does that do the opposite?
I can't speak for all circumstances. It has been scaled back. We still see it happening. And, you know, I really feel strongly that ticketing kids for truancy and ticketing their parents for truancy-related issues, which causes parents to then miss a day at work to go to court, it's not help. I mean, that's not an intervention. That's a punishment.
So it doesn't work to affect truancy?
I don't think so.
Your policy or your approach seems to make a lot of sense, to have wraparound social services in the schools to help kids who need help getting to school and staying in school. And so why isn't it done more widely?
That's a very good question, and that's what our mission is. You know, our mission is not to have communities and schools in every school. Our mission is to ensure that integrated student support models are adopted by school districts across the country. And in some states, that has occurred. In Georgia and Texas, there have been examples of this. And I think Los Angeles Unified is absolutely moving in this direction. There are social workers, there are guidelines. guidance counselors here. There are attendance counselors and college counselors. But our schools are so large, and our poverty levels are so high, and our English language learner population is so high that it's going to take involvement from the community to work in partnership with the districts to scale this concept of these wraparound integrated services.
So basically, you need more in more schools.
We need more and more schools, that's right.
And how many do you have right now? How many schools have these services right now?
In Los Angeles Unified, we are in 13 schools.
Oh, so not very many.
Not very many. That impacts about 15,000 students. Communities and Schools nationally is working with 1.3 million students and their families annually in about 3,000 public schools across the country.
So you're in 13 schools and there are 900 or so schools in LAUSD.
Correct. We got started here in 2007. So fast growing, but a big road ahead of us.
Deborah Marcus, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Chapter of Communities in Schools. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity.
Warren Olney is in the house right now to tell us what's coming up at 1 o'clock.
I am in the house. We're going to be talking about racial bias in policing and how it reflects racial bias in the society as a whole. There's some very interesting research about that, indicating that even African Americans see young black males as more threatening than other people. And there's an objective way to measure that. It's really very interesting and, of course, very challenging for the police. We're also going to talk about the most wanted woman in the world, whose name, according to intelligence agents, is Lady Al-Qaeda. She is sitting currently in a prison in Texas. She is not. No, it is not her given name. She's Pakistani, and she is a Ph.D. From the United States, arrested in Pakistan, charged with attempted murder, actually, of interrogators. But she was apparently associated with Al-Qaeda. And now the Islamic State is trying to demand that she be returned or traded for one of their prisoners. And there's some dispute in Washington as to whether that's a good idea.
Lady Al-Qaeda. Do we know her real name or any other?
We do know her real name, but quite frankly, I can't remember it. And I'd pronounce it incorrectly if I could.
Okay. Well, Lady Al-Qaeda sounds good. It's almost like Lady Macbeth.
That's right.
Warren Olney and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock on KCRW. And coming up before that on this program, why, oh, why did the media fall for a story that was too good to be true? Well, because it involved football. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, USC is trying to dial back an embarrassing story today. Football player Josh Shaw is suspended indefinitely after admitting he made up a story about being a hero. He showed up for practice this week with two injured ankles. He told his coaches he had jumped down from a second-story balcony to rescue his 7-year-old nephew who was struggling in a swimming pool. Well, USC's athletic department ran with the story, so did the media, and now Shaw admits he made the story up. It's really unclear exactly what did happen over the weekend. Bill Plaschke is a sports columnist for the LA Times. He joins me now. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, so did you fall for it too?
You know what? This is such an embarrassing thing. In the beginning, I did not fall for it. It happened. The story appeared on Monday afternoon, a 6-paragraph story generated from USC's website with just quotes from Josh and the coach. No confirmation. There was no journalism done. It was just basically a PR blurb about this. And immediately the alarm bells went off in my head, and I thought, wait a minute, this sounds weird. He jumped off a balcony, but he didn't jump into the pool. He landed on the, or how come he didn't run down the stairs? How come there wasn't somebody else there? The whole thing sounded very weird to me. And I got on the phone with some of our reporters, and I said, boy, this really sounds weird. This really sounds awful. And all I kept hearing back from everybody, not just my reporters, but people in the community, was, man, what a story. What a great story. What a incredible story. And I got worn down, and I said, you know what? I don't want to be that cynical old guy. I don't want, you know, I've been writing sports in town for 30 years. I don't want to become a cynical old man. So you know what? Okay, I'm going with it. Let me interview the kid. I want to set up an interview with the kid. I want to write about him, his road to glory as a hero. So it just shows our need, I think, as a society, and particularly in sports, we always want to see the best in people. We always want to see the game-winning home run. We always want to see the the last-second touchdown, the last-second basket. We always want to see that. And so, yes, at the end of the day, the long answer to your short question was, I was suckered. At the end of the day, I was suckered like everyone else.
So did you talk to Shaw? Did you talk
to
the coach?
No, Shaw, no. So I set up the interview with the kid, and but between me setting up the interview and the time I got over to USC, the story had started to unravel already. And I kicked myself saying, I knew it. Why didn't I follow my instincts? So, yes, no. Josh has not spoken to anyone except through his attorney. You know, he gave a statement apologizing for everything. But it's such a massive fail on so many levels for so many parts of this LA sports community. I mean, it's a huge fail by the USC athletic department for running this without checking it out. You know, they're trying to play journey. If you want to act like a journalist and break a story, then be a journalist and vet that story.
Except, let me just say, this is a PR department, so their job isn't really to break a story. It's to push out good news about the university.
Yes, it is, but that good news, it is intrinsic that good news be accurate news, that they don't print lies. I mean, out-and-out blatant lies. But again, as much as they're at fault, the LA Times is equally, even more so at fault. We're just as at fault. Every media in the country who ran the story, which was everyone, is just his fault because we took their word for it and didn't check it out.
Well, so, it sounded yesterday, though, with the statement by USC, that they're really pinning the blame on Josh Shaw for lying.
Yeah, but and I think that's obviously he's number one with the blame. But no, they got to blame themselves too because he came in and told them a story, and they wanted to hear good news so badly. And I don't blame them. I don't blame him for that. I don't blame him for wanting to print good news. It's a program that just got off probation. They've been through some tough times. They have a new coach, Steve Sarkisian. They're all excited about the new season. They wanted the good news. But you know what? A lot of players come to coaches around in football and say, "This is how I got hurt, and it's weird. I got hurt chasing a dog. I got hurt falling out of bed." And generally, the football programs just kind of say, okay, he got hurt. That's all they announce. They don't announce. They use privacy laws and don't announce the reason for the injury. So USC didn't have to put out the press release and put out the story that they did. But again, I'm saying this all from the knowledge of the LA Times. We shouldn't have picked it up.
And what about the coach? You talked to Steve Sarkisian. What did he say?
He, like the rest of us, he wanted to believe the kid. The kid apparently has a great record. As for character issues, he gave a speech at commencement last year for the student athlete commencement ceremonies. So Steve said, you know what, kid came to me, I wanted to believe it. And I told Steve, I said, the reason I believed it is that I didn't want to be a cynical old man. And Steve looked at me, he goes, I'm the same way. He goes, same here. He agreed. I think all of us are so afraid in sports of getting sucked into all these stories of athletes who do such horrible things off the field that we don't see the beauty of sports, and we're so trying to see it, and we all wanted to see it, and it blew up in our faces. It just blew up in our faces. Now I feel like a gullible. No, I'm not a cynical old man. I'm just a gullible old fool, man. That's what I feel like right now.
Well, also USC has come off a string of bad news. It had to give up its Heisman Trophy.
Oh yeah, they lost the Heisman. They had a terrible. The coach Lane Kiffin was a bad coach before this. It was an embarrassing. Everything was embarrassing. Yes. So they wanted good news. We wanted good news. And I think it's interesting, though, is that the kid got suspended. Both of his ankles are injured, so he can't play anyway. But I'm assuming, I don't know how you feel, but this probably should not be a career ender for the kid. I mean, he lied. Kids do stupid things. He'll probably come back by the end of the season. But the funny thing about it is he comes back at the end of the season and he makes some big play to win a game. The fans will be going crazy cheering for him, and we'll all be surrounding him writing about it. Because we still want – that's the thing about that makes sports different from a lot of parts of life is that everybody still wants to see the hero. Everybody still longs for the soul, the passionate soul of the victor in sports. And in times like these, it makes us look like idiots.
Okay, so meanwhile, now are you guys reporting on what really happened with
Josh
Shaw?
Oh, my God, we're going crazy. Are you kidding me? Yeah, of course we are. Madeline, of course we are. We're the big tough investigators now, right? Yeah, well, of course, yes. And we're checking it, and we should be checking everything about this story. And we're going to stay on it now. Obviously, we've been embarrassed, so we're going to be on this thing. You know, Josh Shaw had no idea what he got himself into when he told this little lie. I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, the thing I can't get over is he held on to this lie for 3 days. He adamantly said he did it for 3 days, when in fact, as it turns out, the only thing we know for sure, his attorney has said that he injured his ankles falling off a balcony in a downtown L.A. apartment complex, not in a Palmdale, you know, apartment house with the pool. This is, he was down. He never got out to Palmdale. So we know that he fell off a balcony somewhere, and that's really all we know for sure. We know his name was named not as a suspect, but his name was named as part of a police report on a potential burglary. But again, that's all, not a suspect, just a name, person, of, you know, whose name on the report. And that's really all we know about any of this stuff. So, but you can bet we're going after it hard now. But again, we're going after it a little bit too, it's a lot, a little bit too late, I would think.
Bill Plaschke, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, I bet you guys have lots to say on that particular story. Our Facebook is KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers is here with the feedback.
Here's the thing. Our listeners haven't fed back yet. Is that the present tense, fed back, or past tense?
They're not
fed
feeding
back?
Right now.
There's no feeding frenzy yet.
There will
so,
be.
So go to our Facebook page, weigh in. You know, there is a quick update to what we just heard, though, from Bill Plaschke. We know that Josh Shaw was suspended indefinitely from the team for lying, but USC head coach Steve Sarkisian just came out saying that Shaw may be brought back to the team at some point this season. So that's the latest development there, and the USC press team is saying that they are going to do a better job fact-checking its press releases in the future.
Well,
so, a little update to the story
from
Bill Plaschke.
Also, cautionary tale for all of us out there.
Right? I'm just reporting the feedback in this segment. That way I won't have to eat my words later.
Exactly. Okay, you won't have to fact-check that. All right. If you want to weigh in on anything, please do. Facebook, KCRW Press Play, voicemail 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Warren Olney to the point up next. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.